minutes past 8 o'clock. This is Metro Talk. Yours truly, Jerry Phillips. Right here at Clear Channel Radio on a Sunday morning. And it's time for our first Sunday political debate. Here they are, ladies and gentlemen, none other than the political debaters. I should say, the ones who come and join us each and every Sunday. And welcome, everybody. Let's see, Nicholas Sawalk, Libertarian.
Morning, Jerry.
Why don't you introduce you? You know, I shouldn't introduce you because then someone's going to say, you're playing favorites.
Ha, ha, ha.
You know, I mean, it was like Bush in the debate last week. Everybody said, well, come on, he looked like he was like egotistical, da-da-da-da-da, only because of the way the man looks. I mean, that's his look. There's Condoleezza Rice on the Today Show this morning. And, you know, maybe they should have used her face with Bush's voice during the debate. Anyway, please introduce yourself.
Nick Sarwark from the Libertarian Party.
What party?
The Libertarian Party.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
I'm Jim Parmley from the Republican Party. And, Jerry, I thought I was your favorite.
Please, sir.
Eric Michelson from the Green Party.
And we welcome a new Democrat in the House this week.
My name is Jennifer Dargan, and I'm proudly a Democrat.
Jennifer, thanks.
Not new.
Not new. You're not a new Democrat.
I'm a long time.
You're a long time proud Democrat.
That's right.
And that's the same you say about being a long time proud Republican.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, let's get to the issues, folks. There's a Bush poll, a Newsweek poll up right now showing that actually 51% of those polled by Newsweek poll felt that Bush did not do enough in Iraq. Iraq was the topic of the debates this past week, and that's what we're going to kind of look at. What is the fallout of the presidential debate? Did it serve its purpose? With now, we're talking about 63 million people, up 37%. From past debates, more Americans watched. Are Americans more interested? And did it really serve its purpose? Nicholas.
I think that more Americans watched this time because they were hoping to see a clear difference between the candidates. And in the case of this debate, they saw that there is not a clear difference between the candidates on the issue of Iraq. They both support staying in Iraq and continuing the what Kerry calls a mistake and what Bush calls the right thing, but they both want to continue it, and they both want to keep our troops there occupying another country and keep the casualties up.
Eric Michelson.
I have to agree with Nick. I think certainly there were some rhetorical differences between the two candidates, but, you know, when Jim Lehrer has to ask several times, so what exactly are your policy differences on this issue for the American people? I think that indicates perhaps that there's a great deal of agreement, at least on these foreign policy issues.
Jim Pomeroy.
Well, let me say, I mean, with Senator Kerry, it's interesting that they asked that question. When Senator Kerry now once again agrees with President Bush, the main debate should have been between Kerry's different positions rather than him versus Bush.
Jennifer.
Well,
and may I say, Jennifer is sitting in for Patrice McKinney, who is normally on our panel, but she's away on business. So therefore, thank you very much, Jennifer, for joining us.
And thank you for welcoming me. I have to say that I think that people who are attached to this idea that there's no difference between the two candidates on the war in Iraq are really just if you're looking at it in the most positive sense of the word, deluding themselves. In a sense, they want to believe that there's no difference because that makes them feel more comfortable in not making a decision and not coming down on a stand one way or the other, and how we went to this war, how this war has been mismanaged in its aftermath, and what plan there will be for not just rebuilding Iraq, but for future conflicts that we will have and how we will address future conflicts and how we will secure this nation. And I really think that what you heard this week was a very stark difference between the two candidates. Kerry would not have gone into this war under the same circumstances. He has said that repeatedly.
He voted for it.
He voted for the authority for the President of the United States to make the decision as a last resort. The President, as we all know sitting here, anyone reading the newspapers, understanding anything at all about the Project for a New American Century, anyone understanding anything about the history of the advisors of the President and reading the newspapers over the past two or three years, understands also that the President decided to go to war on September 12th, 2001.
But a few weeks ago, Senator Kerry was asked, knowing what you know now, would you still go to war? And he said yes, infuriating his liberal base. But it's interesting. He said even knowing what he knows now, Senator Kerry would have gone to war just like President Bush.
I agree with you, only that I think that his explanation of his of his position was clumsy. I do not believe, and he has clarified multiple times since, and people refuse to accept this explanation, that he did not vote. He did not say that he would have voted to go to war. What he said is that he would not change his vote to give the president the authority to make that decision. That is very different. Flip. We're supposed to believe the president of the United States.
That's
flip-flop.
There's a reason we have checks and balances in this country, Jerry, and it isn't so that the Congress can give a rubber stamp to the executive to go to war under whatever circumstances that he wants. I think that the issue is, you know, well, maybe Kerry didn't think that Bush went to war at the appropriate time, but frankly, I think it shows an error of Kerry's judgment to have given this president a rubber stamp to go to war when he wanted to.
Honestly, for Congress at all to abdicate their role in the decision to go to war to the president without taking a vote on the actual merits of the war is not a sign of leadership, and I think that the entire Congress fell down in saying that the president had a blank check. And I think that Kerry's statement that he would have still voted to give the president that blank check does show that for all his talk about how it was a mistake, it's the sort of mistake that he's still going to try and get our allies to be involved with. It's the sort of mistake that he's still committed to stay with for as long as it takes until he feels that it's done right. And it's the sort of mistake that continues to bring body bags home to America. So if it's a mistake, it needs to be rectified.
I'll telephone number 301-230-0980, #980 in the Verizon Wireless System. The first Sunday political debate panel is in session, and we're here with our first Sunday political debate. Nicholas Sawalk, Jim Pomeroy, along with Jennifer Doggan and Eric Mickelson. They all represent various parties, and we certainly want your opinion, and you can certainly express your opinion by giving us a call. My line's open at 301-230-0980, #980 on Verizon. Another question, does Kerry have a substantial place back in the campaign against Bush now? After last Thursday's debate, there was almost like a 360-degree image change. People before the debate saw Kerry one way from sound bites and from what the opponents said. Now after the debate, polls show that people have a different image of Senator Kerry. What about that, Jennifer?
Well, just listening to your introduction, I was chuckling to myself because it's probably the only thing that I'm going to agree with Karl Rove on, and that is that the lead will probably, as documented by the polls anyway, will probably flow back and forth between the two candidates before the election. But I qualify that because I don't think that the polls are necessarily accurate. I honestly believe that we're in an unprecedented era of erroneous polling. We're using lists that were created before, for the most part, before 9/11.
So you don't think the polls are really right at all?
I don't. I do believe that about 70%, I do believe the polls that document the number of people who agree with the U.S. being in Iraq is about 70% that agree with it. And I think that that probably is is why the debate showed such a bounce.
What about that, Jim Pomeroy?
Well, essentially she's reading from the Michael Moore playbook where he's been giving a list of reasons why the pollsters are all wrong. Certainly that's possible, they're using the
same...
Are
they wrong now showing Kerry ahead?
You know, remember, the margin
Excuse
of
me,
error...
Are they wrong now showing Kerry ahead?
Remember, the margin of error in these polls is plus or minus 4 points.
Well, why doesn't that margin come up when Bush or someone else is ahead?
Well, I mean, it does. I mean, if Bush is ahead, I'm going to hear from the Democrats about the margin of error and vice versa. This is a close race all the way through.
Eric?
I think, you know, we can argue about the accuracy of the polling, and that's something that's valid to do as well. But really, I think that Kerry did improve his image with this debate. I think there's no question that he beat Bush both on style and on substance, even though I happen to disagree with a lot of the substance of what he said. I think that he handled himself remarkably well. And, in fact, felt as though if he would have lost this debate, he probably would have been out of it for good. But I think he's really put himself back into the race.
Let's go.
The what?
The comeback kid has started running again.
Trying to figure out how to say that in French.
Thank you very much. Moving right ahead. This week we will have the vice presidential debates on Tuesday night on all of the networks. And people are buying popcorn and sodas and their pizza because they want to sit in front of their television and watch this particular political act. with a young John Edwards, and Democrat, and also
Darth Vader,
and also Vice President Dick Cheney. On telephone number 301-230-0980, #980 in the Verizon Wireless System, lines are open. I'd like to hear from you about what you think will come out of this debate on Tuesday. Now, that's a typical media question. What do you think, Mr. So-and-so, will come out of this debate on Tuesday? People do that all the time without seeing the debate, and they were fooled on the last debate, were they not, last week? Okay, I'll start with you, Nicholas.
I think that they're going to... I don't think there's going to be any surprises from the debate this coming Tuesday any more than there were surprises from this last debate. People expected Kerry to have better debating style than...
No, I'm talking about the vice presidential.
I know you're talking about the vice presidential debate. I don't think that anyone's going to really change their mind about John Edwards or Dick Cheney based on the debate. And I think that it's interesting to note that the third presidential debate, the one that's going to be held in Arizona, the Arizona Libertarian Party just filed an injunction against spending state funds on that debate, because there are three recognized political parties in Arizona, the Republicans, the Democrats, and the Libertarians, and spending state funds on only two of the recognized political parties is unconstitutional in Arizona. And it's not that we don't want there to be presidential debates, it's that there is a third option in this race, Michael Badnarik, who's running on the Libertarian ticket, who is anti-war, and that option is being deliberately blocked from being put in front of the American people.
Is that fair to the Green Party?
No, the Greens suffer from the same situation. There are candidates. David Cobb is on enough ballots in order to statistically win the Electoral College, potentially, and yet he's not being included in the debates. And so
So I go back to my question. What do you think will come out of the vice presidential debate Tuesday night?
Nothing.
I think that, again, it's going to be probably more of the same. I'm not sure how many people are interested in what the vice presidents have to say.
You know, it's interesting. It'll be interesting to see the contrast between the two. Dick Cheney is one of the most experienced, talented men ever to serve as vice president. And he's in
history?
Yes, he is in the top ten, in my opinion. He is extremely experienced. You don't get that a lot, as a vice president. You get people picked because of electoral considerations, things like that. But you're talking about a very talented man who's had a long history of service in government, and then you're looking at John Edwards, who is hasn't even finished a full term in the Senate.
What about that, Jennifer?
Well, I obviously disagree. I think what you're going to see is a billionaire swindler who was head of Halliburton and put together a lot of sweetheart deals.
Only one. Yeah, the billionaire is Edwards.
I think what you'll see is on the other side is a man who earnestly has an ability to connect with people, not just because of his eloquence and ability to be a fantastic communicator, but also because he has lived the life of ordinary people.
But the point is that in this day and time, one of the things that has come out of this campaign is how do I feel comfortable with candidates? People felt that way. Women's vote, for instance, was very high, supporting Bush last week or so, because they felt that Bush was a better leader when it got down to security and terrorism. My question here is, as certainly Jim has raised, experience against the inexperience. Is that what we're seeing in this debate with the vice presidents?
I think to some extent, if you just look at experience, right, Cheney has more experience in government, whether that's a bad thing or a good thing, we can debate. I think the other issue with Dick Cheney in particular, though, is he has to avoid coming off looking smug. And I think that's how George Bush did, and I think that's how Cheney often appears. He looks like he's full of hubris and that he doesn't, he's filled with contempt for his opponents.
I think also historically that vice presidential debates have tended to be entertaining, but at the end of the day, they're not. People understand that person is hopefully not likely to be president immediately, and that's not really going to make most people decide their vote.
The
I do
only
think
thing
it'll
that,
have higher views.
The only thing that's different about this vice presidential debate in that regard is that Dick Cheney is widely reputed to be the most powerful vice president in American history, in so much as he's held more influence and sway over the actual policy of the Bush administration than any previous vice president in our history. And as such, there might be more people who care about what Dick Cheney thinks than other vice presidents in the past.
Oh, look, in this era of terrorism, the phrase, the vice president is a heartbeat away, has never been more concerning. And if you've got someone like John Edwards in there, I would be very concerned for the country.
Or telephone somebody with number, a bad heart like Cheney.
Telephone number 301.
Somebody who knows what he's doing.
Excuse me, you're stepping on the host's line. 301-230-0980, pound 980 on Verizon. Absolutely a free call. This morning, the panel in session here with our first Sunday political debate, along with Eric Mickelson, Green Party. We have Jennifer Doggan, Democrat. Jim Pomedy, Republican, and Libertarian Nicholas Sawalk. Pat and Alexandra, here you go. Here you go, Nicholas. Pat and Alexandra, good morning, my friend.
Good morning, my darling. And considering the state of Dick Cheney's heart, that's not really a good statement to make. I think the only thing you're going to see in this vice presidential debate is you're going to see who can be the best pit bull without annoying the American people.
Ooh.
And I think what you're also going to see is Mr. Cheney becoming annoyed and then getting on his high horse, which he does so well. And then you're going to see Mr. Edwards, the experienced lawyer, enjoying it because he'll just play it all the way down the line. And other than that, I hope it doesn't put me to sleep as quickly as the presidential debates did. Nicholas, have a lovely day. Jerry, enjoy. Bye.
Bye. Thank you very much, Pat. Ron on his cell phone. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. How are you guys?
Fine.
I guess the question is about the vice presidential debate. I personally don't think it's real super relevant, only because I don't think Cheney, because of his age and his health and all that, I don't think he's going to be a candidate at the next presidential election. So he's just going to be, I think, just a figurehead, somebody that's just there in the event of some sort of emergency. So I don't think it's going to mean that much. You got this young guy, like they say, all polished and everything. Cheney, he's a good spokesman in himself. I think it'll be probably a good debate. But that's when people look at the debates, they see things from their own perspective.
Mm-hmm.
My opinion of the presidential debate of the candidates, I think Bush won, in my opinion, simply because just the one remark that the Kerry came out about this global approval for anything that the United States does. I think that's totally, absolutely, 100% wrong, and I think he would sell us out as president.
Okay, hold your point, sir, because this is the controversial statement that Bush made and has raised a lot of eyebrows, and also saying that this was a spinoff turnaround of what he thinks of Kerry. I'll go with my friend Eric first from the Green Party. What about that?
First, I just want to answer first about the outcome of the poll. Almost every polling source, regardless of whether it's generally conservative, liberal, moderate,
including Republicans.
Including Republicans and including the folks from the National Review, a conservative publication, said that Kerry won. I don't think, again, from objectively, you can't say that Kerry won. Maybe you disagree with some of the things that Kerry said, but if you're looking at it from the point of view of an undecided voter, I think Kerry won. Now, the issue of globalism versus a nationalist agenda, I think Kerry did say that he was going to be more attentive as far as including allies and bringing people into discussions, but he also said that he would let no one hold a veto over U.S. foreign policy. So I think he made it, people may see that as flip-flopping.
He did take both sides of the same issue on that. You're hedging both sides of what he said. First, he got very indignant about how we weren't going to have a veto over, that the rest of the world was not going to control our foreign policy. And then he went on and on and on about how he wouldn't act without passing a global test.
But
now,
everybody
what is
knows,
this global test?
But everybody knows, including the president, that we can't do this alone, that the war on terrorism is a global effort. So it's erroneous to say that Kerry ever said he
John Kerry would not do it without passing a quote-unquote global test.
Wait a second. This wasn't about the war on terrorism as much as the president would like it to be. It was about the occupation of Iraq. And I don't see why the occupation of Iraq should be a global effort any more than it should be our effort. And I really don't understand how it is that Mr. Kerry is going to talk about how the occupation was poorly planned, the occupation was poorly thought out and going into it,
liberate,
and then get our allies who have foreign policies that say, we don't go occupy other countries because it's not what we do, to come on board. I don't understand how you're going to convince them to do that.
Let's talk to David. And boy, good morning, David.
Morning. How are you doing?
Fine. Go right ahead.
Let's see. I've got a couple of things. I'm in the military, and I think it was the right thing that we went into Iraq. And people say, well, how's the, what's the juxtaposition between the war of terrorism and the war in Iraq, and how are they related? Well, there, up until recently, there have been very few suicide bombers in Israel. And one of the reasons was that people quickly forgot was Saddam Hussein was $50,000 per family, money for every suicide bomber. And then right after Hussein left or was taken out of power in there, there was a dramatic decrease in terrorism in Israel. There's Saddam Hussein, when the UN would leave him alone, his goal was to ramp up his chemical weapons and his biological weapons. He didn't have them there. That was a misjudgment on the United States CIA and other DIA and other intelligence sources here in this country. But
okay, David, hold your point. Let's get John. Stay with me. Don't leave. John in Fairfax. Let's go to Fairfax. John, you're on the line with David and our panel. Go right ahead.
Hi. You're taking my call. You know, I've been listening to the show, and, you know, Judith has made some comments. You know, that I have to say, she's a little bit delusional as well. When you come on a show like this, I hope to hear a discussion of intelligent opinions, and all she does is make sarcastic comments about President Bush and Vice President Cheney. She refers to him as this billionaire. Cheney grew up humble beginnings in Wyoming and made himself a self-made man. The fact that he worked for Halliburton, should we disqualify anybody who's ever worked in the private sector from public office?
Only if he made that money corruptly.
Which he did. Hold on. He did not. In fact, let me jump right in here. Dick Cheney, when he became vice president, turned over his finances to a separate trust. He is not profiting from any of those.
He has actually profited. He has profited since he has been in office, because the firm itself has continued to bonus him based on his contract,
John,
and the health of the company right now.
Let's get John. John, go ahead.
Information.
Go ahead, John.
I guess Judith would have Rockefeller and Kennedy get out of the public office because they've held stocks in companies that have made money the same way. I mean, let's get real here. You want to live in a fantasy world, then stay on radio or reality.
Excuse me.
David, go ahead.
Okay.
Thanks, John.
Dick Cheney has not made any money from anything that's gone on since he left Halliburton. He is getting paid by an insurance contract that guarantees that he makes X amount of money per the contract that he signed with Halliburton. So he has not made a cent more or less than what he was supposed to make under the existing Halliburton contract. If Halliburton were to go bankrupt today, he would still get the same amount of money that he was supposed to get. If Halliburton were to increase tenfold, he would not get any more money. This is on the record.
And it's okay. a retirement plan. That's all it is. It's not, I mean, yeah, it's even more innocuous than that. It's a contract, but it's a retirement plan.
Okay.
What are you supposed to do? You know, junk his retirement plan?
Thank you very much. Let's go to my friend here, Mr. Nicholas, very quickly.
I just wanted to echo off of David's point. I also come from a military family, and one of the things that the caller said that kind of troubled me is, and this has been said a lot, that Saddam Hussein gave money to suicide bombers in Israel, or gave money to their families after they blew themselves up, which is definitely a threat to Israeli security. But the point at which we've decided that Israeli security is related to U.S. security is the point at which I part ways with the caller.
Greg in Woodbridge, good morning.
Hi, everybody. I'm one of those people still sitting on the edge here trying to figure out which way I'm going. And my biggest question is, my wife and I'm 56, my wife's 55. Together we make a combined salary of about $120,000, $25,000 a year. And I keep hearing, especially from the Kerry campaign, about how the economy of the country stinks. And we're not government employees, by the way. How the economy stinks and how we're in serious trouble. And I get to talk to friends and relatives across the country, and it doesn't seem that way to me. Where do people like us stand? I mean, are we the so-called rich people that we should be paying more taxes?
Well, there are a couple of issues related to the economy that are very unhealthy at the moment. One is the unemployment rate, which, although the Bush campaign keeps saying that it's roughly the same as when Al Gore was running for office 4 years ago, What they don't clarify is that the net loss of jobs has been the worst since Herbert Hoover. And on top of that, what you have also is an exploding deficit that eventually is going to have to be paid for by the reallocation of funds that of federal programs that all of us, you and I, enjoy, including Social Security.
Okay.
I don't even know where to begin with that one. Social Security is a separate item, but, I don't even know where to go on this. Basically, John Kerry is going to tax and spend you to death, sir. You're making $100,000. John Kerry believes that's rich. He's got a whole series of taxes just for you.
Okay, let's talk to Randy in Woodbridge also. Thanks, Greg.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine, Randy. Go right ahead.
Okay, I just want to... I have a question, and I want to... But first, I have a comment.
Very quickly, please.
Okay. I have a problem with the way the Bush administration had gone to this war. They didn't find the weapons of mass destruction. You have to start from there first. And I really believe he does have a credibility problem, not only over here in our own country, but around the world. And I think that's really a problem. And my question is, going forward, why should we give Bush another chance? I mean, it seems to me that since it has gone bad so poorly to this point, why should we continue to think that it's going to get better with Bush?
Well, I'm curious.
Thank
Randy.
You, Randy.
Why should we give Kerry a chance either if Kerry is determined to pursue the same policies as Bush and to continue this ill-fated war? Why shouldn't we vote for somebody like Michael Badnarik who supports bringing the troops in?
What's that
website?
What's his name? You know, I don't even know
Michael Badnarik. He's appearing at American University Butler boardroom from 3 to 4 p.m.
Any man with the word B-A-D in his name has got to be suspicious.
And what's that website?
Bad what? What's his last name?
Badnarik.
Badnarik.
Badnarik. B-A-D-N-A-R-I-K.
Sounds like a fruit juice they serve in Japan or something, you know?
Could I also, though, just echo in on something that the caller raises, and that is that you do, you know, all of us wish that we could trust our president. And if we were brought into this conflict under false circumstances and a biased view of the intelligence previously, then how can we trust him under future conflict?
But how can we trust Kerry to keep us there?
Excuse me, folks. We're going to turn the page now and go on to another part of our agenda, and that is local politics. Baseball's coming to Washington, D.C., and the hoopla was ever, ever overwhelming last week. Everybody is ready for hitting the old ball across the plate and running around three bases. But now we're hearing from the other side of the story. Well, three, you know, until you get to home plate,
right.
It makes four.
Right.
Those Republicans, you know, they always have to interrupt. You know what I mean? Now, there's another side of the story, and that is from the communities that feel they may have to pay for this beautiful extravaganza. One man appeared in the Washington Post yesterday, and he's not alone, but he has been alone in standing out and standing up to those baseball lovers. Councilmember Adrian Fenty is on the line. Good morning, Councilmember.
Good morning, Jerry.
Thanks for joining us. And also, while we have you on the line, we want to ask you about the gun ban, too.
Sure.
Because you have a citizen out in Southeast who was running for Ward 8 against Marion Barry. She lost. But she says that as far as she's concerned, Sandra S.S. Seegers, she sent me this email saying that the 250 members of the House of Representatives finally have come to their senses by realizing that D.C. citizens actually deserve the right to bear arms. Okay, that's another story. Boy, that could be a whole show.
Yeah.
But let's go with the baseball first. What is the basic problem? I know you don't object to baseball, but what are the objections to baseball?
Well, that's right. No, I'm a baseball fan.
Like
oxymoron,
huh?
No, I'm a baseball fan. I think most people in the city are very enthusiastic about baseball coming. But what's coming through loud and clear is that a full public subsidy for a new baseball stadium is not on the priority list of district residents.
Go ahead.
I mean, I hate to cut it short, but that really is the gist of it. I mean, you can expound upon it and talk about what are people's priorities and the fact that the people who own baseball are going to get a huge windfall off of this and could easily pay for the stadium themselves. But when it comes right down to it, residents are telling me that if we're going to raise taxes on businesses, then that money should just very simply go to better priorities. I mean, fixing playgrounds at schools that have gone unfixed for decades.
Well, let me, I mean, and I'm not a big fan of taxes, so, but don't take my position on this particular item. But let me just say, D.C. government has a ton of cash. It's always had a ton of cash. The problem is D.C. mismanages its money. I think Mayor Williams is doing a better job than we have in the past. But, you know, the problem in D.C. is not enough revenue. It's wasting money.
Well, but you got to tell that to the parents who've got their kids in schools with leaky roofs.
Well, I mean, they're spending $12,000 a student, $12,000 a year per student. Why can't someone fix the leaks? Oh, that's right, because there's a lot of ripoffs with the contractors.
Again, you're going to take money, you're going to raise taxes and give it to a privately owned company to build a baseball stadium. It just doesn't fit into the set of priorities that at least my constituents have. I can't really, you know, go back and forth. My job is to represent my constituents, and they weighed in pretty loudly on this one.
Councilman Fenty, it's Jennifer Dargan.
Sure.
And one of the funding proposals that the mayor's office has put forward is to have taxes on businesses pay for the building of the new stadium in 3 years. What effect do you think that's going to have on Washington businesses?
That's a good question. And again, you could raise the same taxes to pay for needed school improvements or needed library improvements. I think the jury's out. I think some businesses could probably absorb it, but I think, you know, making a blanket declaration that all businesses support being, you know, getting their taxes increased is a little bit hard to swallow. I think most businesses think that they're taxed enough and have no relation to a baseball stadium and would rather not be taxed, quite frankly. But all taxes, there are no voluntary taxes, and this is a decision that the D.C. government will make, and we cannot go around saying that we're making it because businesses volunteer for it. The other big issue here is that we have a stadium in the District of Columbia. That stadium will be used, even under the mayor's plan, for 3 years to house the new baseball team. It doesn't make sense to district residents that you just can't let the team play there long term. And then, should these private owners want to build a new stadium for themselves, that's fine. But we'll renovate RFK and they can play there. It will cost us a lot less money.
Mr. Councilman, we got phone calls and questions from the panel, but I want to make one thing clear. The vote comes up before the city council this week, right?
No, that it won't come up until probably November. We have to have a hearing first. We have to get the public.
I meant the hearings. I'm sorry. I meant the hearings come up this week.
Probably in the next couple of weeks. You're right.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Eric?
I think on this issue, Jerry, we need to separate the emotional from the economic issue. Certainly, as a sports fan, I think it's great that baseball is coming to D.C. But for people to say that this is going to be an engine for economic development simply is countered by the facts. If you look at every other location where there's been a publicly funded ball stadium, the economic development has been meager at best. If you want to really use economic development, you can put that $400 million into, you know, seeding small businesses in D.C. or doing other kinds of things to actually help entrepreneurs get off the ground.
If baseball really makes money for the community and really makes money for the owners, then the owners should pay for it, and they shouldn't take tax dollars out of the citizens and the businesses of D.C. to pay for their own little boondoggle.
Well, this is $400 million in taxes, and I don't like taxes, but this is going to be taxes on people inside the stadium, so you've got that, and it's a tax on businesses that essentially sounds like it is voluntary.
But the reason why Washington lost baseball to begin with is partly because of low attendance, and this is not a terrific team. And at $150 for a family of four to attend the games, how many people in Washington will actually really be able to take advantage?
Let's go to Bob in D.C. and find out. Hello, Bob.
How you doing? The problem I have with you, Congressman, Councilman Fendi, is that while I hear you complaining about the increasing of taxes to raise funding for this baseball stadium, you know, what about just, you know, it's like you're not complaining we're increasing taxes. You're just complaining we're not increasing taxes to pay for social programs. And as far as I know, D.C. is number one in terms of money we spend on schools. Why is that not enough already? And all we've done, the only thing I've seen with D.C., we always talk about helping the poor and why that's a good thing. All we do is seem to turn D.C. into a magnet for the poor. The middle class has left D.C. Our tax burden is 3% higher than both Maryland and Virginia. Why don't you have a problem with that?
Well, again, Let me frame the point. The D.C. City Council, including myself, has not increased taxes for anything over the past 3 or 4 years. We have not increased taxes to pay for schools, libraries, rec centers, homeless shelters, anything. So for us to now, on the verge of this request for Major League Baseball to reverse course and raise taxes to pay for a baseball team to have a private stadium really seems to be counter to everything we've stood for. The District of Columbia government has the one of the best balanced budgets in the country, certainly in the region. And we've done that by holding the line on taxes. I don't think it makes sense to raise taxes. And again, this is not my personal position. This is the position that I hear from my constituents.
Let me ask you,
who don't want us to have the wrong priorities.
Let me ask you, Mr. Fenty, as well as panel, in this morning's Washington Post front page, Maryland, Virginia fans could make stadium a tax winner. Mayor Williams is saying, quote, "I believe it's going to bring new people and tax money to our city," unquote. How do you address that?
Well, first, let's just clear something up. The end payment on the stadium is going to be about $780 million. Mm-hmm. It's a $440 million bond, but over 30 years, it will cost the District of Columbia taxpayers at least $780 million. That is, unless if it doesn't even go, if there's no cost overruns. But I think that's another point that I'm hearing from my constituents, is if you have a lot of people coming in from the suburbs who are going to be using this stadium, then why are we going to have district businesses pay for it?
Okay, let's go to our phones. Brian on the cell phone. I'm sorry, Eric, I'll come to you.
Okay.
Good morning, Brian.
Yeah. Hey, good morning, Jerry. Councilman Fenty, I was impressed when you took office and you pledged the long and standing incumbent. But what I'm hearing from you is that right now you're saying this is not your personal position, but it's the position of your constituents. It almost sounds like a person who's voting based on popularity versus what sound judgment. Now, and I'm not, trying to denigrate you or anything, but that just doesn't seem like a leadership role. Now, here's my problem is that we can see, I'm not a politician, I'm not a statistician, but I can tell that the MCI Center has vastly improved downtown D.C. No matter who built it, no matter how it got there, it's there. It improved the area.
But let me ask you, Brian, let me ask you, number one, I think what Adrian Fenty is saying is that he represents his constituency. In saying that, any politician is going to say that. But another point about the MCI Center, you got to understand that Chinatown is not in place anymore. The Chinese businesses and many of the Chinese entrepreneurs were moved out, including citizens, because of the new businesses that have come down. It helps the city, yes, but it has disrupted a neighborhood. Is that right, Adrian Fenty?
Not only that, Jerry, but we didn't pay for MCI Arena.
Right,
they didn't pay for. We did pay for about $80 million in infrastructure improvements, but that was all to roads and subway systems, which are publicly owned. So that makes a lot of sense.
Okay, Councilman, I understand that, and I realize that, but let's face facts. We would not have gotten this opportunity to have this baseball team if we hadn't had a good financial package that was including a stadium. I mean,
okay, Brian.
Isn't that true?
Okay, thanks, Brian. Only because of time. Eric?
So basically, we were extorted into getting a baseball team. But wait a second. Jerry, just on the issue of Maryland, D.C. residents helping to make this a tax winner, if you look at, there's a Brookings Institution report on state publicly funded stadiums, and they looked at the Baltimore Camden Yards, which is one of the most profitable of these kinds of stadiums, precisely because so many people from outside D.C., Maryland, Virginia come because there aren't really any other options. But now there is another option. Even with that stadium, where it's one of the most profitable, there was a $300 million investment, and they make $3 million a year. That's a 1% return on that investment. That's pathetic.
I'd like to ask the councilman what he thinks of the mayor railroading this proposal through the lame duck council, with the incoming council being completely opposed to this tax funding of the stadium, and what that says about the quote-unquote public support for getting baseball in D.C.
This is a great question, because it goes right to that last caller's point, where I've gotten this question from emailers where they think I'm an appointed official who's supposed to ignore the constituency. No, as Jerry said, my job and the mayor's job is to listen to the constituency and to represent them. And the three council members who were just elected all said very publicly that they do not support full public financing. All do want baseball, and all of them agree that we should renovate RFK to have this team. And all of three of those people won by 20%. I mean, the huge margins. They got rid of incumbents who were in there. I think what people are not realizing is that to residents of the District of Columbia, this financing package is hugely objectionable. Maybe to the region it's not, but to people who actually live here, it is, and those are the people who we are paid to represent.
Okay, Mr. Fendi, and I can't see you. I'm telling everybody else, kind of make your answer short because we've got a load of calls,
all right.
Okay? We're talking with Nicholas Starwalk along with Jim Pomeli and Jennifer Doggin and Eric Nicholson here in the panel. On the line is Councilmember Adrian Fenty, who is with the District of Columbia Council, and he's been one of the persons to come out and forth and say, we like baseball, but, and that behind the but is what you're hearing from the communities as to whether they want to pay for it or not, and that's the big question on the plate. Jerry in Fairfax, good morning.
I totally agree with Councilman Fenty in that businesses and corporations do not pay taxes. All they do is relay those charges right on to me and you, the consumer. And this package is not going to affect just the D.C. residents. It's going to affect the entire region, Maryland and Virginia consumers. I would avoid patronizing D.C. businesses just to keep from paying those outrageous taxes.
Okay, thank you very much, Jerry. Let's talk to Jim in D.C.
Good morning, panel. Good morning, councilman. I had the pleasure of working on bringing baseball to the Tampa-St. Petersburg area. I would respectfully disagree with the councilman in so much as the Petco Park, which has just recently been built in San Diego, the park in Colorado, the Coors Field, Jacobs Field in Cleveland have all brought tremendous urban renewal projects into the area of new businesses, and where once was urban blight, there is no urban blight now. It is a wonderful, vibrant area in each city, in San Diego, in Denver, and in Cleveland. So as well as I respect the councilman and his constituents, I would say that the mayor has a good point in what he's done, and he's used the template in San Diego, in Denver, and in Cleveland, that all these parks were put in areas like the Anacostia area, and they have become very successful magnets to bring people to that area.
Okay, thank you, Jim. Councilmember Fenty?
Yeah, I can only speak about Cleveland and the district because I know where those stadiums are planning on being built. In Cleveland, it was in the flats. In D.C., it's right on the Anacostia waterfront, right by South Capitol. These are areas that are ripe for boom, just like a lot of other waterfronts in big cities. You know, if we were going to have an economic boom from baseball, it would have happened, in the Bronx where they have Yankee Stadium and other places where they aren't kind of by the waterfront.
Let's get Tony on the line. Tony in D.C., good morning.
Good morning.
Very quickly.
I'm a D.C. resident, and my only point is I agree with Mr. Fenty because I have kids who are in school in D.C. with roof leaks, car damage, and I say if you're going to tax those high businesses for more money, why not put it into the school? Why not put it into the library? And for the person on the panel who states that the former team left because of attendance, that's wrong. They left because the owner found more money in another state, which you can look at the old Baltimore Colts and see the same thing that happened.
Okay. Thank you very much, Tony. Panelists, you've heard what the public is saying, and certainly Councilmember Fenty. Councilmember Fenty, before you go, you got about 30 seconds. I know we have to get you back on the show
Yes. To
talk about the gun ban being lifted in the District of Columbia. I'm going to go around the panel and ask yes or no. Do you think that Congress... the United States House of Representatives is right in abolishing the gun ban in the District of Columbia, and are they right in actually digging into the heart of home rule, saying, hey, you know, you can't even vote on this. And I'll start with my friend Nicholas Sawalk of the Libertarian, quickly.
I think that the people of the District of Columbia have a right to defend themselves just like every other citizen of this country, and the Constitution does overrule home
rule. Okay, let's go with my man Eric Mickelson, Green Party.
I think if Congress wants to get involved in fighting for the rights of D.C. residents, it should give them a voting representative in Congress.
And Jim Homily, Republican.
I would respectfully suggest the council spend more time taking guns out of the hands of criminals and not taking guns out of the hands of private citizens protected by the Constitution.
And also Jennifer Doggin, Democrat.
I think that Congress should respect the people of D.C. who have spoken through their council members and in their
council
own
members.
They do not want this.
Councilmember Adrian Finch, you got about 10 seconds.
This decision was political. This is a month before the election. And then once again, it's a violation of home rule.
Thank you very much, Mr. Councilmember, for being with us this morning, and we'll talk to you down the line.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Well, folks, that's our panel. Boy, I tell you, we're going to come back with the first Sunday roundtable panel again at the end of this month. Will you guys join me the weekend before the election?
Absolutely.
I'm sure Jim Pomeroy will have a lot to say, and huh?
I just wanted to say that Michael Badnarik is appearing in D.C. today at American University.
This bad guy.
If we're making plugs, please, yeah. Everyone is listening.
Go to Ohio and see President Bush.
Not a plug, just to let D.C. residents know
that. John Kerry.
Just to let D.C. residents know that they can see Michael Badnarik at American University at 3 p.m. today.
Don't put anybody on American University's campus.
And on a very serious note.
Santa Claus showed up at Christmas on the campus.
At 3 p.m. in the Butler boardroom.
Yeah, sure.
On a very serious note, no matter what your party, hope that people do realize that for the state of Virginia and D.C. that the voting registration deadline is coming up. Please do register to vote and exercise that right.
Definitely vote. And also the district Monday, you must register. If
you can go to any giant grocery store in Northern Virginia.
Right. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, everybody, for being with us. I know you're looking at me, Jim. Republicans, you know, not a press conference. Thank you very much, everybody. All my panelists here, sort of Eric Mickelson, and Jennifer Doggin, thank you for sitting for Patrice, Democrat, Jim Pomeroy, our good Republican friend, and my good Libertarian friend, Nicholas Sawalk. Hey, I've got to get out of here and say thank you to all of those who helped to put it together. Steve Solomon, our technical producer, along with Carolina Restrepo, our researcher and administration, Shaheen, public assistant, public affairs assistant, written and produced by yours truly, Jerry Phillips. Metro Talk is a WBIG, Big 100.3, and the WTEM, Sports Talk 980, public affairs presentation from Clear Channel Radio in Washington, D.C. It's going to be a gorgeous day. Get out and enjoy it. Much peace, much love.